And welcome to the podcast, everybody. This week, we're going to do a little comedy, followed by some artwork. And there is a show at the Second City. If you live in Chicago or the Chicago area, you're a huge fan of Second City. I try and see as many shows there as I can. But, you know, when you walk in the building, you may notice that they kind of say what show you're seeing, where you're going, because there are various stages that you can which you can be watching a show. Most people think about the main stage and seeing the Second City players who we kind of are familiar with getting ready to go off to New York, that kind of thing. But you know what? You're doing yourself a disservice if you don't check out some of the other stages. And indeed, playing in on one of those stages is a show called How to Have Chill Vibes in a Nuclear War. And these are sort of graduates of the study program at Second City. And they do their own show. And I saw it recently, and I got to tell you, it's only playing through May 5th, so you really want to get with it. I got to tell you, this was one of the funniest shows I've ever seen, and in my opinion, as funny as main stage shows that you have seen, and so you don't want to miss out on it. Let me introduce you to one of the stars of this show, Justin Fullerton, who's part of the ensemble cast. Justin, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Paul. How's it going?
I'm doing well. Well, you guys, there's eight of you. Eight of you guys are on there.
Yeah.
And it is just, it is crazy stuff. Talk to me about, because you were students at Second City, now you're doing the show. Talk to me about the process of getting this thing created.
Yeah, so basically we are students or members of the Severn Darden Graduate Program, which is kind of, we all went through the Second City Conservatory Program and then had to audition for this kind of graduate program. And eight of us got it in this particular group, and then what we've basically been doing is performing every Saturday since last June, I believe. So coming up on close to a year. But performing every Saturday, we started for like 6 to 7 months of just doing improvised sets every night. Right. So we got kind of accustomed to, you know, performing for live audience members every night on the Second City stage. It's in the Blackout Cabaret. So, it was a great experience and helps you mold and hone your skills. And then they switch out directors every few months so that we get a broad range of experience.
Ah.
And then kind of the last 3 months of the program, we work with one specific director to write an entirely new show. And that's what you saw with How to Have Chill Vibes in a Nuclear War.
And it's a series of skits, great skits. I mean, I literally did laugh all the way through. And so I have to let me just mention a couple of them for you in terms of what one of the funniest. I don't know, because I've got a whole list of everything that I loved. But one of the funniest things to me, it's this funeral. Unfortunately, this was not one of your starring moments, but it was the funeral parlor scene. You actually play a corpse.
But hey, I can star dead.
That's right. So, but let me. I'll throw that in there. And then there's mm-hmm. one in which there's a restaurant, emotional food descriptions, all this stuff. Do you guys sit around and sort of how do you craft the ideas and then craft these skits? There's a little improvisation too, where the audience yells things out. I was certainly part of helping that out.
right, and giving great suggestions.
Trying.
So what we would do is, kind of each week, our director would give us kind of a general topic of, like, you know, write a emotional scene or write a two-person scene. And then we would bring that, meet in the afternoons and pitch ideas to each other, and then improvise it. And then as you improvise, if you find things that you like, you write that down. Then you go up and re-improvise. And one of the cool aspects of this program was that we would bring in stuff earlier that afternoon and then put it into a show later that night. So we were getting immediate feedback on what works, what doesn't work, and how to fine-tune each of these sketches. And so, like, a lot of the ones that you mentioned were heavily influenced by Josh. I know he is one of the
Josh
members.
Vanderpool, yeah. He's hysterical, by the way. He's like the Jim Belushi of your group, or the John Belushi, I would say.
I can definitely see that. And in both of the scenes, like Julia as well, both of them are great physical comedians. And so basically we ended up kind of just writing with different members, kind of pitching these ideas, collaborating on some things. And then ultimately our director took our just bucket of sketches and then fit like a theme to it, shook it out and had to do those hard cuts of what sketches made it in and what didn't. but came up with this final result, which I think I'm very honored to be a part of. This show.
It is so good. There's this bomb shelter scene where, I don't want to give too much away for folks who don't see it, but let's just say a lot of people get shot.
I mean, we say nuclear war in the title. So I think...
I guess we know something's coming like that.
Exactly.
But what's funny is, within this scene, you attack political parties. You attack, I mean, it's just, there's all these things that are almost, that make people irate when they hear them. And sure enough, we get these moments of it in the skits. That's what I loved about the show. You tap into these almost Seinfeldian, Jerry Seinfeldian things, the kind of things you think about all the time, but you don't really articulate or talk about. And then there they are for a moment on stage, and you guys just treat it in the funniest way.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's one of the great opportunities about performing at Second City is they really push the satire aspect. So dealing with the mundane or dealing with those things that you see every day that frustrates you, or you make comments to yourself in your head, but then when you see somebody else articulate that on stage, you can lean in and go, yes, this. So like the women of our cast are awesome, and they've written you saw like the People Suck scene or the songs that they wrote.
Right.
Please Don't Harass Me. So, like, they have some excellently well constructed and thought out songs that bring up, like, daily experiences that you're like, oh, this is frustrating. Well, where do I get it out? On stage. Let's sing about it.
Exactly.
And then that allows people to, kind of really...
really
come
relate
to terms
it.
With it.
There's a song. There's this trio of women scene where it's really about objectifying women.
Yeah.
And I just right. You know what I'm talking about. And it's just so funny because unless the women sort of talk like they're little kids and they're powerless, then the men go with it. But as soon as they start to sound like they're an equal, the men can't handle it. And I mean, again, such a reflection of life.
Yeah, there's a lot of those scenes that, and I think that we like Hannah, Carrie, Rebecca, Julia, Mo. All of them are such good writers that they managed to deliver those different moments where it was like, hey, we'll tap into this so you know what we're talking about, but still do it in a fun way, you know, where it's like you're not being hit over the head. I think that kind of embodies that whole satire aspect where it's that thing that you recognize and makes you uncomfortable a little, but that you can still laugh at.
And I got to say, I'm gonna give one thing away because towards the end of the show, there was a song where you guys sing Give Up On Your Dreams. You know, just like, forget it. I put me on the floor because I just thought every show in the world is going to talk about live for your dreams and I dreamed a dream and everything else. And there you are, guys, going, nah, just forget about it.
Yeah, like let somebody else do it. Somebody else handle all the problems because we've been lied to this whole time. That's the kind of fun thing where it's... that song, you end up and you're like, oh, I kind of was expecting the, live your best self, keep fighting.
Right.
And instead, you get hit with that. And so I think it kind of leaves the audience to be like, well, I don't want to give up on my dreams. So I'm going to go do my dreams now.
Well, it was a packed house, which, you know, again, main stage you'd expect to be packed. I wasn't sure what I would see when I went to one of the smaller stages. But you know what? Packed house. And I assume you've been playing packed houses every week. Well, people just love to go see this stuff.
We have. Yeah, well, and we have been blessed to have sold out the majority of our shows. And that's one of those things where I, like I said, I'm just so honored to be a part of such a good show. That has been able to create this buzz in Second City. And it's kind of cool, like you were mentioning earlier, is, you know, people know, go to the main stage to see the big players. I think that this is an opportunity and maybe one of the reasons why people are coming out, because it's kind of an opportunity to see who's next, who's the young up and coming people who are about to...
So the next, as you guys bring this to a close on May 5th, do you all know what's next for you, or is it a matter of, no, it's the next project, the next show, we'll see?
I mean, yeah, so some of our members have other shows that they're currently working on. Some are kind of like, I know myself, I don't have like a set lined up thing, but I have some ideas that are in the works. So basically, it's one of those things that is... kind of characteristic of the life of the actor, where it's like, I know what I'm doing for the next two weekends.
Right.
And then, we'll see what happens. But
you,
like
you could
said,
change fields. You can go into and, you can go into physical therapy somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So now it's kind of like, what's the next creative opportunity?
Yeah.
What do you create or what? And fortunately, now we have experience writing with some of these great members, and so I'm looking forward to working with them more, you know, going forward.
Each one really does their own thing and presents just such a classic character. I mean, I truly do see future SNL members on that stage. So I congratulate you, Josh Vanderpool and Joe Vargo. I mean, just some of these characters, these faces, Hannah Engel, just incredible performance. Let me encourage everybody. The show is called How to Have Chill Vibes in a Nuclear War. And it is on, as you said, Justin, the Blackout Cabaret at Second City. 8:30. It's one show a week. You only get two more Saturdays through May 5th, so don't miss it. It is, I promise you, you'll have a great time. And you can go to secondcity.com to get the tickets, but don't just show up because you'll probably find it sold out. I know I reserved ahead of time to make sure I got in.
It's true.
Thank you, Justin. Congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me on, Paul.
All right, good
really
luck.
Appreciate
good
it.
Luck with the rest of the run.
Right,
give my best to the cast.
A brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy. On the way I dropped it. I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it. A little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket.
Oh, what a great song. What a great voice. Depending on your age, you know who that is, or maybe you don't. So I think we need to teach you about the woman who was known as the First Lady of Song, the Queen of Jazz, Mama Jazz. Oh, what a star she was. Ella Fitzgerald was her name, one of the great jazz singers of all time. By the way, she co-wrote that song. We'll talk about that. But that famous song, yeah, she was also a songwriter. And there is a new book that is just coming out. It's called Ella, A Biography of the Legendary Ella Fitzgerald. It's coming out because Ella would turn, if I've got it right, 100 years old this year, her centennial year. I actually have read the book, and first of all, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. We'll talk about it. It is the Centennial Birthday Edition, and there is a special edition that has CDs, a two CD set that have been carefully put together for this new project. Let's talk to the author. Let's talk to the guy who's such an expert on Ella Fitzgerald and has all the insight and connections to write what he has written. Jeffrey Mark joins me. Jeffrey himself, by the way, is like a walking encyclopedia of show business history. This guy is amazing. I've checked out his Facebook page. We're connected there. I don't think there's a living celebrity that he isn't tied to or connected to. He himself is a performer off-Broadway, and he's written a bunch of books on Lucy and Ethel Merman. It's just great stuff. Let's get to it. Jeffrey, welcome to the podcast.
Always, always happy to be with you, Paul.
You know, this is, I know you've written other books, and you've got so many ties in the celebrity industry, but Ella was special for you. Am I right? And because, in fact, you had the ties, you knew her, and in many ways, you knew that this was a book that had to be written. In fact, it was suggested, this book has to be written.
It was. First of all, thank you for reading the book. You'd be amazed when you're publicizing something like this, and they read the press release, but they don't know the book. So thank you. See, folks, this is why you listen to this man, because he knows what he's talking about.
Hey, by the way, I'll tell you, nice. I always read the book. Oh, I think that you respect your author when you do that, and that's what I want to do. You'll be able to tell as we talk that I have.
That's why I will always do Paul's show, because he knows what he's talking about. As a performer, you love getting respect. I think any of us, whatever job we do, we enjoy being respected for doing a good job. I thank you for your kind words. I really do appreciate it. I was very fortunate, and I am attracted to and attached to Ella on so many different levels now in my life. I knew her towards the end of her life when her health was failing, her memory was failing. I helped pick out songs for her to sing in her concerts. I knew the people who were working with her towards the end of her life, interacted with them. It was their idea the book could get written originally. Didn't work out that way, but it ended up being an independent book, independent of her. Happily, the estate and her charitable foundation are big supporters. And some of the money from that deluxe version of the book you were talking about is going to the foundation to keep what Ella wanted, the helping working class people keep their heads above water financially.
In fact, you wrote that this was to be a book about a career in music. But as you got into it, began writing this while she was still around, you realized, no, it had to be much more than that.
Well, and I think the reason why we all react to celebrities, all of us, whether we're in the business or we're in some other business, we're fans. And this singer, this comedian, this actor resonates with us. And I never quite understood why Ella resonated with me so well. Well, she loses her mother before she's 15 and she's on her own. Well, I was on my own at 15. Ella was physically and emotionally abused and raped and, by all accounts, tortured. Well, unfortunately, so was I. Didn't know this as a fan of her music. Didn't know this going into the writing of the book. Found this out doing the research and went, wow, the parallels. No wonder I am drawn to her. There's something in the vibe that just drew me in. I understood her. I understood her voice. I understood her music. And here we are, Grammy nominated for writing album notes for her. So she's a huge part of my life.
And I know that you were close with her engineer, Val, or Valentine, I guess, was his full name. And he was one of the folks who said, we can't lose this story. But as I go through the, actually, I'm gonna get off my script for a moment and say that I don't have a script, but to say this. What amazed me as I started to read the book was you have this photo record at the beginning of the book. Oftentimes, when people write books like this, you kind of go to the middle and there's a little section of photos. And maybe two-thirds of the way through, you get another little section of photos. You chose to lead this book off with these gorgeous photos, portraits, whatever. This is high quality stuff in this book. So I'm curious to know why you chose to sort of say, I'm going to lead this book. Let's start with the portrait history to begin with before we ever get into the history of Ella Fitzgerald. Or was it just to suck us in to make sure we read it?
No. You're asking a really good question. I'm asked all the time by potential writers or friends of mine who are writing biographies or their own autobiography, Jeff, you've been successful at this. I've had a couple of bestsellers. How do you put a book together to really sell? I said, this is what the fans look for. First, they're going to look at the index and see who you're talking about. Ooh, Marilyn Monroe. Ooh, Frank Sinatra. Ooh, this person. Oh, yes, there are going to be stories in here I'm going to want to see. Then they're going to look at the pictures to see what memories. Because, again, we have an emotional response to this stuff. Well, if they're going to do that, two little four-page or six-page or eight-page sections that are out of order, out of sequence, and not related to anything you're reading in the middle of the book, why put it in the middle of the book? Why not put a photo essay up front that shows you the progression of, in this case, Ella Fitzgerald, from being a teenage girl to the last professional picture taken of her. And by looking through it, you see a progression of life, and you see Count Basie and Duke Ellington and Frank Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe and Carol Burnett. And you go, oh, yes, I remember. Oh, I remember that show. Oh, that album, of course. Now you want to start reading about it. So it's not a sucker punch. It's an appetizer.
It is. And by the way, as I mentioned, these are gorgeous portraits because my memory is you actually had Annie Leibovitz photo. Ella posed for Annie Leibovitz back in the late 80s, I think. And what a gorgeous, she was wearing this red outfit, this leopard coat. Because what I'm saying is that these aren't just pictures of her with these celebrities. These are portraits. These are really magnificent pictures. I just got to say, I when I opened it up and first began to see that, it brought me in and I found myself going, no, I'm going to actually look at all of these before I get into the text of the book. So by the way, brava on that, because smart move.
Thank you. We have Ella by Picasso.
Yes.
We have Ella by Hirschfeld. We tried really hard to put into this the best of what was available and paid a lot of money for it, quite frankly. Yeah. That's why the book is a little pricey, folks. But it's worth it because it's chock full, because it isn't just those pictures up front, like 70 pages of pictures up front, but through the entire book, we didn't put in eight more pages. We have the photos and posters and album covers all throughout the book. So as you're turning pages, there are graphics that relate to exactly what I'm talking about at that moment. So if I'm talking, I'll pick one out of the air. If I'm talking about Ella's Dream Dancing album from the late 1970s of Nelson Riddle, there's a picture of the cover as I'm talking about it.
Right. Well, it's brilliant. I also love the fact that you had to have a blast writing this because you got to interact and reach out to so many celebrities, and we all get a little starstruck. And what I remember reading is that not only was everybody open and willing to help you, but there was one exception, which was Dinah Shore. And it wasn't that she wasn't willing to help you. She was too ill, but she still said, Jeff, here's Mike, take a look at everything, and had everything open to you.
There, you talk about a class act. You know, people think class is knowing a fine wine with dinner or which fork to use when there are 17 forks on the table. That's polish. To me, class is how you treat other people. I reached out to Dinah, and I said, I'm not going to interview you about your friendship with her, but you are the person with whom she worked with the most on television. Could we talk about what it was like, et cetera, et cetera? And I got a call saying, look, I have cancer. I look terrible. I'm not letting anybody see me anymore. I'm not doing any more public appearances. I'm really not up to being interviewed. But I understand what you're trying to do. Go to thus and such address at thus and such date and time, and they're going to pull out all the kinescopes and videotapes of my shows at Ella Fitzgerald. And they will let you stay there all day long and take notes and see everything because I want the book to be excellent for her. That is class.
That was absolutely class. And she was a classy woman. I mean, Carol Burnett, Tony Bennett, Nelson Riddle, everybody's in here. I happen to have a favorite. It's Louis Armstrong.
I'll tell you a Louis story.
Oh, but I was going to say, you know what? Do it, because I can't get enough of him. And of course, even as a kid, I have the Ella Fitzgerald Louis Armstrong CD. Well, maybe that wasn't a kid. Maybe it was later. There were albums when I was a kid. But anyway, can you tell me about that friendship, that relationship? It's magical to me.
Sure, because it's amazing. They sing nothing alike. Their approach to jazz is very, very different. But they were very, very good friends. Billie Holiday sang more like Louis Armstrong. He was an influence on Billie and Sarah Vaughan. He wasn't much of a musical influence on Ella, but they were good buddies. They did some singles together for Decca in the 40s and early 50s. But then when she went on to Verve Records through Norman Granz, her manager, Verve Records was started for her. And they did a series of albums of Ella and Louis in the studio, no arrangements, just five or six top-flight jazz musicians with Oscar Peterson at the piano. And then they did one beautiful orchestral with rehearsal of Porgy and Bess, with Louis and Ella singing the entire score together. They never recorded together after that. But what he would do, because Ella was a very shy person, very, very shy. She loved jazz. She loved musicians. She loved musicians. So before they would record a song, he'd whisper something incredibly naughty in her ear to get her to giggle just before the downbeat, so that all of their songs had this joyful sound to it because she's stifling a laugh. And he called her sis. And I can't say on the air the things he would say in her ear, but use your imagination. Hey, sis. And then some filth would come out of his mouth, and Oscar Peterson would start playing.
I love
it. So that fun comes through in the music.
That's a great story. There's something else you structured. That it's easy to look back at this now and go, well, I get that, but that's not the way I read books. I looked at this, and I kind of wonder what's in the author's head when they're making the decision to do this. So you have organized this book based on the recording companies, the Decca years, the Verve years, the independent years, the Pablo, Picasso years, if you will. But these are all record labels. You know, you could have said Ella the early years, and I mean, I would have expected a biography to be structured that way. Was it just because she's inseparable from her music, so it would make sense that if she was sitting with you, she'd say, you know what, Jeff, let's organize this by the record producing companies that recorded me?
You know, I could probably give you 17 different reasons why I did it this way, but I think the easiest is, because you said a wonderful sentence, she was so tied to her music. So when she was doing Decca, Decca was her original recording label, for those of you fans out there who don't know this, from 1935 to 1955, for 20 years. But Ella was not happy at Decca. She had some big hits with them along the way, but by the time she became a mature woman, they were still expecting this little girl thing out of her. They were expecting novelty songs, like A Tisket a Tasket, or scat singing like How High the Moon. She wanted to record great music with great musicians, and Decca didn't often allow her that. So when she moves into the Verve catalog, her life changes, her career changes, her direction changes. When Verve fired her, if you can imagine, 10 years later, because rock and roll was coming in and rock music, each label she went to affected her life. She was making more money. She was making less money. She was now doing more television, or she was now appearing in Europe more often. So the record labels do kind of govern what her life was like. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I think you really hit the nail on the head. So tied to the music was she that when the music changed, so did Ella Jane Fitzgerald's life change.
And you mentioned, I think, briefly Marilyn Monroe. I wanted to come back to Marilyn Monroe. This is just, that's not a tie. I mean, look, I listen to a lot of Ella's music. I'm a fan of her music, but you taught me so much in this book about her life, and I wouldn't have tied her to Marilyn Monroe. And essentially, you make the point, Marilyn Monroe being such a sensitive person, and yet she had Ella's back. People forget that back in the 50s, I don't care how big a star you were, you're Sammy Davis Jr., you're Ella Fitzgerald, you, Madam Star or Mr. Star, you're not coming through the front door of that restaurant. You're not entering through the front door of that hotel. Sammy Davis Jr. fought it, and Ella Fitzgerald fought it, but she fought it with the help of Marilyn Monroe. I know you know the story I'm talking about, so can you tell us that?
Of course. Sure. And you know what? Unless you do research, you wouldn't find these stories. Unless you talk to the players themselves and go, hey, I've got a story for you I bet you haven't heard. And of course, I would go, yes, please tell me that story. And this is not just Marilyn, the thing I'm about to say.
Yeah.
There is something about the highly sensitive actor studio kind of actors of the 1950s, the Marlon Brandos and the Marilyn Monroes and the people like that who were so high strung. And there is something in Ella's voice, and again, I can relate to that, that when she's joyous, I feel joyous. But when I'm feeling blue and I hear her sing, this is an amazing comment, and I have it in the book, but in a different place. When Ella sang a heartbreaking song, you didn't hear her heartbreak, you heard your heartbreak. And these highly sensitive people would, like Marilyn, would get into bed and just put on Ella and drink champagne and chill out. Mm. Other people would take a shower or a bath or smoke a joint or whatever they did to feel better, and they did it with Ella. So because of that, Marilyn particularly had the time and the money to show up wherever Ella was performing. And they became buddies because she was there. Ella was having trouble getting booked into the really big nightclubs because the Verve years where she does her best work had not yet started. And Ella told her. So Marilyn went to the owners of the club in question and said, look, I'm Marilyn Monroe. You book Ella Fitzgerald, and here's what I'm going to do. Every single night, the 10 nights of the engagement, I will book a table for 10. Those 10 people will be the biggest stars and singers in show business, and there'll be a different 10 every single night. It won't matter if she fails. You will make a fortune because they'll all be looking at us. Now, of course, Ella didn't fail, but Ella never had trouble getting booked in a big nightclub again because of Marilyn Monroe. Very soon after this, Ella was in Colorado, and Marilyn was there, and the press was there to take pictures of these two icons. Now, you mentioned a good thing, black woman. So there's both of these things going on. In 2018, African-Americans and females are still struggling to get their fair share of whatever is going on. So being a black woman, okay, and now she's with the white goddess. There they are together at this club, and they've taken all the pictures, they've done all the press, and now it's time to go in, and she's being ushered into the back of the house. Oh, no, we can't let you go into the front of the house. And Marilyn puts her arm through Ella's, and Marilyn did not talk a little breathy talks, except when she was on camera. In real life, she knew how to raise her voice. And she said in a very loud voice, Marilyn Monroe and Ella Fitzgerald are entering through the front of this building, or Marilyn Monroe and Ella Fitzgerald are not entering at all. Needless to say, they got in through the front door, and never, ever again was Ella shown a back door anywhere. I think it's the earliest example I can use of girl power, long before that phrase came into being. Marilyn taught Ella, you have power as a celebrity and as a woman, and it's okay to use that to further your career and get treated the way you deserve to be treated. And Ella began to change because of that. So Marilyn was an influence on her.
What a great story. And you know what? I mean, that teaches me as much about Marilyn Monroe as it does about Ella Fitzgerald. I would not have guessed that story, but how magnificent of a woman she was as well.
Marilyn was not the bleached blonde, empty bubblehead people thought she was. She was great at playing that on the screen, and like many of us, myself included, did not always make great choices romantically. But she knew what she was doing, and she was not stupid at all. Perhaps not educated, but not stupid. And when she needed to stand up for herself, she did. And got in trouble for it. Men did not like women who were not aggressive, but assertive. And Marilyn tried her best to be assertive, and Ella learned how to be, too. She had to. All women in show business back then, there are so many stories about other people we could talk about, Joan Crawford, Lucille Ball, Ethel Merman, who are rapped because, oh, they were a bitch. No, they weren't a bitch. They were trying to do what men do, which is assert themselves and do the best they can with the talent God gave them. If a man was doing it, you'd go, what a guy. When a woman did it, oh, no, they're being fill in some word that isn't very nice about them. So Marilyn got a bad rap. I think had she lived longer, had she lived past the sex symbol thing, we would have found out there was a really wonderful woman there.
Thank
you.
We
had mutual friends. Several mutual friends, and I've heard, maybe I should write a book about Marilyn, but so many books have been written. One of these days, Paul, when I'm older, because I'd like to live longer, one of these days, when I'm getting close to the end of my life, I will tell you the story of Marilyn Monroe's last day, because I know it. But yeah. I can't do it now, because if I tell it, you'll be doing my obituary tomorrow. I don't want that to happen quite yet.
Well, you realize that after this interview, you're going to get a phone call from me to hear that story down the line, but we'll hold off on that.
I understand. That is what... We'll hold off on that.
All right. Hey, you know what? You also quote Steve Allen, the great Steve Allen, in the book. And the quote, as I remember it, was that Ella had no peers. There was Ella, and then there's everybody else. I know he meant that musically, but I feel like that's a broader concept, a broader statement.
Well, Steve, I'm a lucky man. I really am. All the names I'm dropping, I never got to meet Miss Monroe. I was 3 or 4 years old when she died. But the other people we're talking about, I've known all these people. And Steve was a mentor of mine. He allowed me to use his song to end the book. He wrote a song for Ella and knew her quite well. And she was his favorite singer.
Some people didn't know, by the way, Steve Allen himself was not just a comedian, whatever. He was a songwriter. Like, this could be the start of something big. He wrote some great stuff.
And Picnic and lots of other things. If I may do a side story, you talk about heartbreak. I was producing and writing a show for TLC about I Love Lucy. And Lucille Ball's original writers, the people who wrote I Love Lucy, first wrote for Steve Allen. So I was interviewing him on camera for that show I was doing for TLC. And we had known each other for several years at that point. And as I was leaving, he said, hey, Jeff, you write lyrics, right? I said, yeah. He said, you know, I've got 30, 40 tunes that I've never had anyone put lyrics to. Let me send them to you. And pick out 10 that you really like. Let's collaborate. And of course, I was 6 feet off the floor walking out of his offices. He died 4 days later. Never had a chance to collaborate with him. And I spoke to his wife, Jane. She said, Jeff, there's just too much going on here. And I really have no interest in new Steve Allen songs at this point. But again, for fate and timing, I might have been a collaborator on a Steve Allen song. He was a wonderful composer.
Indeed. I also want to highlight, as we're running out of time, but, you know, I should mention, you've got, there's a whole series of appendices. Yes, I looked at those too, at the back of the book, because this isn't just the biography of Ella. I mean, it is, but it's just so much more. It's kind of like the complete kit in one. You write about the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation. You actually mentioned that up front, that the proceeds or some of the proceeds would go to that. Fill folks in on what that foundation, it's still around, it still works. What does it do?
Oh, yeah. Ella had originally, while she was alive, there was an Ella Fitzgerald, a children's center in Watts in Los Angeles, a place for kids to go and stay out of trouble, yeah, for young people. She funded that entirely with her own money. She took no contributions. It was literally, this is my dough, here, go use it. But when she passed away, her estate went in a different direction, and that center has been closed. So her estate money, besides what went to her son, is in this charitable foundation, and it exists to help, as I said at the beginning of the program, people who are working people, people who have jobs, who have families, but you're a husband and a wife, and you're both working two jobs just to keep your nose above water, and one of you loses one of your jobs, or your car breaks down, or you get behind in a rent payment or a mortgage payment, or the phone bill soars, and you can't pay it. Help for people who are helping themselves but are floundering a little bit. And that's where Ella's heart was, to help people who are helping themselves. I've heard that not just from Ella, but from almost everybody in show business. And probably you, Paul, are hit up the same way. We're all hit up for money. Everybody wants a hand. Some people want a handout. And I've heard from the smartest and the best, I will help anybody who's trying to help themselves, who's working the hardest they can to improve their lives, they have a goal, they're doing the footwork, I'm happy to lend a hand to that. People who are just sitting back and doing nothing and asking for help, I won't help with that. Ella wanted to help those people who like she, picked themselves up and worked, but struggled. She knew what struggle meant. She knew what hunger meant. She knew what homelessness meant. She knew what not feeling loved meant, and she wanted to help those people who had those feelings but were trying. Because like me, like her, we tried. We had awful things happen to us, and we persevered anyway. Maybe we persevered because of it. We didn't become victims. It's so important in life not to be a victim. Bad things happen to everybody.
Large message indeed. Jeff, before I let you go, and I unfortunately have to because we're running out of time, but I have to ask two quick things. You have this amazing appendix of the 100 songs Ella never did record, and that intrigued me because I went, why would we make a list of songs she never recorded? And I believe it's probably, I'm going to ask you briefly, but probably because people think she recorded them. But also, as I looked, actually, I thought she had recorded Pennies from Heaven, so there's my contribution. But then you had other songs like the Whiz Medley, and I thought, or is this also a way that people confused Ella with people like Lena Horne? And so give me just a brief rendition of the 100 songs that she never recorded. Was it because of confusion, or was it because people just think she did it?
A little bit of everything. There's so much in there because there's that whole long list of everything she ever recorded. And then I thought, but this isn't everything. There's so much more she could have done. There were also a lot of things that she did live in concert that never got onto a live album and were never recorded in a studio. And I wanted people to know about them, too. Ella did sing a Whiz medley in the late 1970s. It was never recorded where anyone could hear it, except in my lap in the audience where I shouldn't have had a tape recorder going, but but not commercially available. So part of it is some of these she did do live, but no way to get to them. And others were songs I wished she had recorded.
Does that mean we'll hear them one day? I mean, if you do have a recording, it may not be great tape. Will we hear it?
I'm working on that, young man.
All
I'm
right.
working on that.
I'm glad.
I'm happy enough with the deluxe version of the book. And I know we're running out of time, so you'll tell me whether we have time to talk about that or not. But there's stuff in there that will blow your mind.
Well, I did want to ask you, but you know what? I also wanted you to briefly tell the story when she passed away, how she passed away, because what a way to go. And I'm talking about the jazz band that set up outside her door.
Well, I will tell you this. In writing that, and every time I read it, I cry. And I'd like you all, I'm going to give you a real short version. Folks, I could for 20 minutes tell you this story and you'd all be sobbing wherever you happen to be sitting. I want you to read the book and read it the way I wrote it. But the short version is that they knew it was going to be the last 24 hours or so of her life. And she was at home because she had the money enough to do that. And her son had her piano moved up near her bedroom, and they hired a jazz trio. And he gave them a list of her songs, the things she loved to sing in live concerts. And the trio thought that they were playing for a party, only there was nobody there. And they played for hours and didn't know why they were playing. And finally, her son came out and said, "You've been playing for Ella Fitzgerald, the music of her life. She just passed. Would you please play her off?" And they started to cry. I'm getting choked up. And they played the Tisket and Tasket. And one last time, Ella was played off the stage. But as I say in the book, this time there was no encore.
It was just, it choked me up when I read about it, too. What a way to go. And the last thing she heard was indeed her own music, so important to her. I did mention at the beginning there is a deluxe set that comes with CDs. I do want to allow you to talk about that for a moment, because I know that you would put some of her shows together, and these, and the thing, once again, we don't take these things for granted, you would sort of craft the songs she should sing and put them together on the CD, and the order in which they should be sung, or the order in which, in this case, we should hear them.
What I did was, and again, I'll do this briefly because I know we're out of time. I did a show a year ago with the great Patty Austin at the Grammy Museum in Salute, Ella Fitzgerald. And I happened to run into a guy there from Universal Music. And he said, "Jeff, did you know that Decca and Verve, the first two companies, are under one, we're all one big company now?" I said, "Well, no, I've worked for both companies. I've been Grammy nominated from them. But so you're now one company. Isn't that great?" He said, "Yeah, and we also own Capitol Records now." "Wow, Ella's third company, isn't that great?" He said, "And we distribute Pablo." I said, "So except for a couple of years of her life, you guys have your hands on all of her music. Wouldn't it be great to put some of it in the book?" It took us months, kids, months of negotiations. There's two CDs in the deluxe edition. One is all studio work from the late 30s to 1990. One is all live work. Ella is the most live recorded singer in history. And that's from the late 40s to the late 70s. And I put them in the exact order Ella would have sung them if she were doing this as a concert. So you get to hear it flow the way she would want you to flow. Nobody ever thought of doing this. It's the only place where you can get an overview of her entire career in one place. And I'm very proud of it.
Well, Jeffrey Mark, you've written an absolutely stellar book, and I have to say I have it in my hand, so people, when they buy it, will understand what I mean about how beautiful it is, how sturdy it is to hold, and a fine tribute. If Ella could see this book, she would say, "Jeff, you did a great job, and thank you for all that you've done." And you know, it makes me, I'm going to be checking out just other stuff that you've written, because I'm a huge Lucy fan, and we can talk about that one other day as well with our connections there. I own her. I have her sunglasses and all various things. But anyway, but Jeffrey Mark, so people that want to get the book, what is the best way to get it? Amazon?
Amazon.com, the regular version of the book is there, the deluxe edition is there, and there is an online version of the book now, too. So the online version doesn't have all the music and a lot of the pictures, because you can't do that, but at least the text of the book is there with some pictures. So it's available in all three. The best way is Amazon.com, and if you want it autographed, find me on Facebook, GeoffreyMark. I say hello to everybody. And you want something autographed, we'll work it out for you.
Oh, how perfect. I want to play out with a little Ella, because we have to do that. How could we not? But if you don't mind, the personal privilege is doing a little Ella with Louis Armstrong, because I just kind of like it. If you don't mind, I love that stuff. Jeffrey Mark.
I'll be in heaven.
All right, Jeffrey Mark, thank you for your time. Congratulations on the book. It is Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. It is a centennial birthday edition. It's not missing a trick. You don't want to miss it. And here is our little tribute to Ella.
Cheek to cheek,
yes, dance with me.
cheek to cheek.